today on Against the Grain. After the Soviet Union collapsed, its welfare system was dismantled, privatization proceeded apace, and unemployment soared. So how did ordinary Russians cope and survive? I'm C.S. Song. We get answers and insights from the geographer Mariana Pavlovskaya coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We tend to forget, amidst all the talk on the left about universal free education and free healthcare and a guaranteed basic income and the like, we tend to forget that advanced levels of welfare provisioning were a fundamental feature of the Soviet state. Now, those social support systems were far from perfect, but imagine what happened when they dematerialized after the USSR collapsed and the transition to capitalism began. Unemployment soared, life expectancies plummeted, and people were expected to somehow make it on their own. How ordinary Russians coped, adapted, and managed to survive, how they were able to cushion the shock of the neoliberal transition, is the topic of today's program, and we turn for answers to Mariana Pavlovskaya. Pavlovskaya is a professor of geography at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center, and some of the extensive research she's done into informal economies in post-Soviet Russia are laid out in a chapter she contributed to the new volume, Making Other Worlds Possible, Performing Diverse Economies. When Mariana Pavlovskaya joined me from a studio on the Hunter campus, she said she was trying to do several things in that chapter.
One is to show that profit maximization and competition in the economy is not the only way to build successful economic projects. Another point is to show that caring about others and caring as part of the economy is not an afterthought of the economy, right? It's not some kind of side thing, but it could be thought of as to be a very, very important part of it. Then one more goal probably of this chapter was to show how in the times when formal economy doesn't work and state institutions that supposedly provide welfare no longer work either, how people engaged in different economic practices continue to support themselves and the society. And this is kind of very much invisible part of the economy because we don't think about the economy in this way. But in case of Soviet Union that experienced this collapse and post-socialist transformation in Russia created such a context in which these informal economic practices that are based on cooperation and care came forward, right? Not in official policy or research, but in everyday lives of people. And they made a difference. They made a difference. They allowed the society to carry on under very, very arduous circumstances.
Let's go back to the Soviet era. And I'd like you to talk about the main features of what might be called the welfare system as it existed and as it operated in the USSR.
Yes, the welfare system in the former Soviet Union was very, very different from the one in the United States. First of all, it was universal. It means that certain benefits were given to every single person. And these benefits are extremely significant as we understand today. For example, free education, free healthcare, free childcare, housing. So all those were benefits that were given to every single person. In addition to that, there were groups in the society that were given additional welfare benefits, primarily in kind. And so those include, for example, veterans of World War II or retired people. So those had right, for example, to free public transportation that other citizens did not have. So those were two very, very important features of the Soviet welfare system.
So by universal, you are saying that the Soviet state did not provide these benefits just to those in economic need.
Exactly. All members of the Soviet society could receive education for free, for example. So here you have a tension because on the one hand, you kind of want to provide support to those members of the society that are in greatest need. But on the other hand, once you ask this question, then you have to develop the criteria to determine who is in need and whose need is bigger than somebody else's. And how much do you have to give to respond to this particular person's need as opposed to the other person's need. So in Soviet Union, I guess the idea was that because everybody is a member of socialist society and there is no poverty, for example, so everybody is just entitled to those benefits.
What about guaranteed full employment, which was the official state policy? Does that mean everybody got a job?
Exactly. So according to the law, people had right to work. Basically, a lot of people never were without the work for any significant period of time. People were kind of transitioning from one employment to another. And so the idea was that everybody always was employed and always was receiving a living wage. But on the other hand, some people thought that was authoritarian imposition of the need to work on people. There were some people, and I'm thinking particularly like, you know, more or less affluent, middle class, young people who didn't want to work right after they finished college or something like that. So in many cases, those people would be obliged to work. So they would be considered parasites in the society, somebody who is not providing any useful service to the society. And actually, there were laws that would prevent people from staying out of work for the long time.
Now, Mariana, you write in this chapter that scholars in the West characterized the Soviet welfare system in terms of both excess and lack. Explain what you mean.
I think that a lot of our theories that explain how economy works and how welfare systems work in different societies, they are normative in some ways. So they are guided by a particular understanding of what economy should be and what a good welfare system should be. And in the West, the Western way of organizing welfare, which is targeted and is needs-based and also monetized, is considered to be a golden standard because it is A, efficient, and B, it reaches to those whom it intends to help. So from that point of view, what existed in the former Soviet Union doesn't look very good. On the one hand, the system is lacking the rationality and logic of the Western welfare systems. If you give something to everybody, the whole basis for welfare policies that have to assist particular groups of people doesn't make sense. On the other hand, this kind of universal access to all these benefits is considered to be very wasteful and exuberant. This is the term that I use in this chapter. So it is some kind of welfare in the state of excess. So you give people more than they need. So you are kind of wasting things instead of being parsimonious, instead of being targeted to particular needs, instead of being justified financially. So you are just on this kind of spending spree or something like that. So both of those things, right, they would position the Soviet welfare system as deficient relative to Western welfare systems. And I think that was very, very powerful way to evaluate it that also led to its dismantling without any debate or struggle.
Well, Western observers also liked to point to the fact that there was often, or there were sometimes, shortages of goods and a lack of selection, these kinds of things.
In the former Soviet Union, oh, absolutely. But this is different from the principle on which the welfare system was organized. So in principle, all citizens had right to those benefits. How they were delivered in reality is a different question. And in the former Soviet Union, especially now looking back, I would say that a lot of those benefits were delivered at a decent level. They were not delivered at the highest possible level, but they were delivered at a decent level. For example, all children could go to school. College education was available to vast groups of the society, and social mobility in terms of transition from working class to intelligentsia, as they call it, or middle class educated professional group, was unbelievable during those Soviet years. At the same time, the quality of education you could get varied based upon where you lived. But it doesn't mean that people didn't have access to education at all.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Mariana Pavlovskaya joins me. She's professor of geography at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. And we are talking about an article, a chapter she contributed to the new volume, Making Other Worlds Possible, Performing Diverse Economies. What do you think of the argument, Mariana, that since the Soviet political system was repressive, we should dismiss the welfare provisioning and the social supports that that system provided?
Well, I think that was the biggest mistake that post-socialist countries committed when their authoritarian governments collapsed. The mistake is actually very, very hard to identify, because in our imagination, we only have basically two economic systems that are opposite to each other. We have capitalist economy, market-based economy, which is efficient, which is providing to everybody who is working, gives an opportunity to accumulate personal wealth. And this system does not require vast welfare. It doesn't need welfare because it provides economic opportunity. And the state in this kind of the economy has to play a minimal role because it basically only constrains the economic creativity. So the state functions and welfare provision by the state should be as minimal as possible. And on the other hand, we have the countries of the former Soviet Union and Soviet bloc, the so-called state socialist societies. So there, the economy was not privately owned. It was owned by the state. It was fully controlled by the state. The state also controlled politically its citizens, and welfare that was provided in this kind of view is often interpreted as compensation for economic control and kind of paying for compliance of the citizens who are asked to live in this system. So in capitalist economy, you have freedom because the state is small and citizens can express their views freely. And then in the former Soviet Union, you have state control, but at the same time, with one hand, the state controls you, with the other hand, the state gives you all these benefits. And so then when the former Soviet Union came to this crucial choice, do we want to have the authoritarian system anymore or we don't? The choice was no, we don't. And because it was so closely associated with state welfare, then it meant by default that we no longer support this welfare system at all.
Let's talk about what happened to the Soviet era welfare supports and social security nets after the USSR collapsed. Can you talk about the dismantling of those supports? You refer in this chapter to a three-stage process.
Yes. So the process occurred in three broad stages. I think the most significant change took place shortly after 1991. So this is when the transition to capitalism was legalized. So this is when private property was created. This is when full employment was no longer obligatory. And this is when this kind of broad commitments to those universal welfare provisioning, such as free education and free housing and so on, were no longer there. So some things still remained in place, but no longer the economy and the state were obliged to give those things to the people. Because now Russia and other countries of the former Soviet Union were thinking of themselves as becoming capitalist societies. So that situation kind of took place for some time, and the immediate result was the emergence of unemployment. And unemployment was something totally new for the post-Soviet society. As we already mentioned earlier, virtually all people had a job before, and suddenly to find yourself to be unemployed and without any opportunity to find a job was very, very tragic for many people.
Well, what did the growing unemployment in the early post-Soviet era, what did that do to people's livelihoods and to the hardships that they began to have to endure?
Well, in the former Soviet Union, that produced devastating effects, and it was extremely difficult period of time that was reflected in devastating demographic statistics. For example, in 1990s, life expectancy for the whole country in Russia went down significantly, and it really plummeted for men. At some point, life expectancy for men was about 56, 57 years. A lot of men were unable to find work. They were unable to support their families. Many of them engaged into self-destructive behavior, and many of them committed suicides. So that was very, very difficult time.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Mariana Pavlovskaya joins us. She's a geography professor at Hunter College and City University of New York Graduate Center. So it sounds to me like, Mariana, that just at the moment when welfare is most needed, in an atmosphere, in a landscape when people are losing jobs and becoming economically desperate, that is precisely the moment, the time when welfare was eliminated or drastically reduced in Russia.
You're absolutely right, CS. This is exactly what happened. And this happened for a number of reasons. One was that, you know, the whole focus was on privatization of the economy, on implementation of the reforms that would transform the state socialist economy into a capitalist economy. And in order to do that, you had to privatize state assets at the scale which was, I think, unseen before in the 20th century, that's for sure. You also needed to open prices. You also needed to open the economy to foreign investment. So you needed to do all these things, and this is where the struggle was. The major fight was over privatization. So how one can privatize state assets as soon as possible. And the sooner you do it, the least likely you will be able to go back to the Soviet system that many actually thought to be like the major fault of it, they thought, would be not that it was state socialism system, but that it was authoritarian system. So that was kind of one moment why the welfare at this point wasn't a central concern. Another one was that the economy actually collapsed. the industrial output went down, and only recently, actually, Russia recovered the late post-Soviet outputs, industrial output levels. So the economy was devastated. State no longer had money. So there was no means to actually provide any payments or finance social programs at this time. And also nobody knew how to do it because the Soviet mechanisms that were in place, they were kind of destroyed. And all Western consultants who came in, they were talking about how to do privatization, not how to build welfare immediately to provide safety net to people who would be pushed out of employment and deprived of sources of income.
Let's talk about what you call, what's called household economies. So to what extent did it fall on Russian families and households and household economies to find a way to somehow absorb the shock of the post-Soviet transition?
In my opinion, that was the only way for the society to continue at this point, because places of employment were devastated. People would still go to work in some cases, but they won't be paid. Wage arrears at this time reached months and almost like a year in some cases. So in this kind of situation, it was very difficult for people to come up with the money. And as a result, they had to resort to alternative sources of production of goods and services. And some of it would be to engage in various kind of informal jobs and moonlighting, like, you know, doing little job here and there for at least some income. So kind of they would be engaging into various economic practices, trying to raise some income. But a lot of things can be done without raising income. For example, instead of buying food, you can grow food. Or instead of buying food in the store in downtown Moscow, where the food would be expensive if it is there, you could go to your village, the village where your family is from, and arrange for some direct purchases of meat or vegetables with people in this village, and then bring all that back to Moscow and then share it not only with your own family but with families of your friends. So people would start doing these kinds of things. Another thing is that a lot of domestic responsibilities became more difficult to carry out, in the sense that, for example, with disintegration of childcare and remaining childcare institutions, so then the question of what your children are going to do while you're at work became very, very important. So in this case, many families made decisions for women to no longer work at all. So women kind of returned to their households to take care of children, and very often they would be helping other households in those situations as well. So, okay, today you bring your children to me and I'm going to look after them. Then tomorrow you can look after my children while I have to do other things.
You are pointing, Mariana, to a kind of resourcefulness, an extraordinary resourcefulness, a necessary resourcefulness. And I'm wondering to what extent that kind of thinking and doing had been cultivated and developed during the Soviet era.
Well, I think a lot of it actually was cultivated and developed during the Soviet era for two reasons. One is that the Soviet economy wasn't abundant in consumer goods. This is not like they were not absent. People had things, but they didn't have them in very, very big quantities. But very often, and especially towards the end of the Soviet Union, there were more significant shortages of consumer goods. For example, people would go to the store and they, oh my God, there is no toothpaste today. Or they would, let's say you need to buy a pair of shoes, you go to the store, there is no shoes in the store. So next time when you go to the pharmacy and you see the toothpaste, then you are going to buy not just one for yourself, but you're going to buy several of them, and you're going to share them with your friends. And then you know that your friend who's going to go to the store at some point to buy shoes for herself, she will also buy shoes for you, because she knows what you need. And once she's there, she will be thinking not just about herself, but about somebody else. So one part of this kind of resourcefulness and this kind of idea that, oh, we can do things ourselves, we know how to fix things, we know how to sew, we know how to knit, we know how to cook, all these things from very, very simple ingredients, stemmed from the fact that the consumption levels in the former Soviet Union were much, much lower than in the American society, for example. But on the other hand, the Soviet Union cultivated this ethic of collectivity and caring about each other. A lot of it was ideological, you know, this idea that you live in the society and you have responsibilities to the society, you have responsibilities to your loved ones, you have responsibilities to your friends, you have to care about them, you have to think about them, you have to help each other, and this is the right way to do things. So people who were thinking about themselves and their successes would be called egoistical. So individualistic values in the Soviet Union were not in high regard. So as a result, when the Soviet Union collapsed, all these values were still in place. And this allowed people to kind of come together and solve a lot of daily tasks together. And that was not a new thing for them. It was like a natural way, normal way to do it.
Mariana Pavlovskaya, professor of geography at Hunter College. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with her about how people got by in post-Soviet Russia, given the tremendous shock of transition that in some ways, in many ways, continues till today. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Mariana Pavlovskaya is my guest. She is a geography professor at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. And she's done a lot of research into what happened in Russia in the post-Soviet era. And some of that research is summarized in an article, a very interesting article that she wrote that's part of a new volume called Making Other Worlds Possible. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. All right, so in a sense, there is a division between the formal economy of waged employment and market-based transactions and the informal economy, which is kind of off the books and involves mutual aid and bartering and sharing and the domestic production of goods and services. Do you have a sense of how big the informal economy was as compared with the formal economy in the 1990s and perhaps in the knots as well?
Of course, there is no precise numbers, but there were studies of the informal economy in the former Soviet Union. And in the context of the former Soviet Union, it is called the second economy. And of course, no data was available, but still there were estimates that in the late Soviet period, about 12% of Soviet population earned incomes in the second economy. So people were supplementing their wages that were not very high. They were not desperate, but they were not very high. And people wanted high consumption levels, so they were supplementing them by working off the books. When the Soviet Union collapsed and when the transition to capitalism began, the idea was that this informal or second economy will disappear. And the logic was that, on the one hand, formalization of enterprise will absorb this kind of entrepreneurial activity that already existed under the Soviet system. So it would be formalized. It will go from gray to white, right? It will become part of the formal economy. At the same time, the idea is that, in general, once societies develop from pre-modern to modern and then to post-modern, the space for informal economy shrinks. So informal economy seems to be associated in this kind of view with what is happening in the societies that are not capitalist yet.
Right, like you're growing your own food in your little subsistence plot, for example.
Yes, so you would think you would do it in, I don't know, rural Colombia, right? But not in New York City, for example, right? Or not in Moscow. But all this does not hold true because people continue to engage into those economic practices, and there is huge urban agriculture in New York City, and urban residents in Russia are famous for growing food on their duchess or summer houses. And rural residents in the former Soviet Union, in the post-Soviet times, also were cultivating crops and also tending livestock on the tiny personal plots that were given to them by the farms in which they were employed. So those were not state farm fields, but their own little plot of land where they could grow things for subsistence, but also to sell surplus at the market. So all these things actually became even more important once the Soviet system was abolished. And according to some estimates, because you can only estimate informal economy, in the 1990s, informal economy contributed up to 40% of GDP produced in Russia. So that is a very, very big number.
Yeah, and what does that number say about the reach of capitalism if, in fact, Russians have resorted to informal economic practices to the extent that you and others have revealed?
Well, this exactly points to the fact that the transition as it was envisioned by Boris Yeltsin's government and Western economists who were consulting the Russian government about how to implement this transition, their ideas didn't really work. I think they were talking about short, painful period. You just kind of let capitalism sort itself out. Because it is a natural way for people to organize the society, you just need to remove the barriers. And so once the Soviet system was abolished and they created some legal framework for private property and so on, then the idea was that, yes, people just all become entrepreneurs and capitalists overnight, and they all become part of the formal capitalist economy. But this didn't obviously work.
Now, one could look at this taking on by households and communities of the economic burden. One could see that in two ways. One as a manifestation of autonomy and of people power. And on the other, one could see it as a mechanism for preserving capitalism, for making the transition to capitalism possible. And so really serving state interests by allowing people to somehow survive in the face of devastatingly quick attempts to move a huge economy from one paradigm to another.
Yes, and I'm trying to address some of this in this chapter. And I think you very nicely articulated those two functions that household economies and this kind of community-based economy can do. So yes, on the one hand, it is manifestation of autonomy and agency and ability of people to provide for themselves and to do the economy according to their ethical considerations, as opposed to what they are told to do either by the Soviet state or the capitalist paradigm, right? That they all have to be utility maximizers and all this kind of stuff. But at the same time, and I already mentioned it, the fact that people engaged into that prevented the society from the collapse. And so I agree with you that they kind of they picked up the slack of the transition theorists and the Russian government during this transition. But I think it is probably more the former. I think people organize economy according to a whole range of considerations, and they are very active in doing so. We just don't think about a lot of economic practices as the economy. We only think of economy in a very singular and specific way as something which is recorded, which produces profit, which adds to GDP and all this kind of stuff. And we don't consider all these other things as being part of the economy. But it is, and people always participate in it, and it is where they have authorship, right? They have power and autonomy in terms of what they do. That, however, does not mean to say that this is what people have to do, that they should totally kind of distance themselves from demands on the state, on demands on the economy, and on the society in general, because it is the society that needs to provide for the people who live in it. So I'm always very, very cautious, when we celebrate agency and households and their creativity and resourcefulness and ability of people to do things by themselves, at the expense of continuing to make political and other claims on the state and on the economy in which they live. Probably a more useful way is to take ethical components of those household and community economies and try to extrapolate them on the larger economy, to try to think whether a larger economy can also work according to the ethical considerations, as opposed to being organized in such a way that it brings profit to the few people and marginalizes many more.
Mariana Pavlovskaya is my guest. She teaches geography at Hunter College, City University of New York. And we are talking about an article she wrote about household and informal economies in post-Soviet Russia. It's part of a new volume called Making Other Worlds Possible, Performing Diverse Economies. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. We have links to that book as well as to Mariana's faculty page at Hunter College on our website, againstthegrain.org. What do you think is the consequence of informal household economies being essentially invisible, being essentially ignored by policymakers, by economists, by the official sector? What do you think are the costs, the drawbacks of that invisibility, and why do you think it's important to bring these practices, these alternative economic practices, to light?
The drawbacks, in my view, are multiple. One of them that it actually allows then the state and the economy to continue to kind of ride the wave of households without really acknowledging their contribution. So the government can implement very responsible economic policies and still have certain assurance that people are going to take care of themselves. without really giving them credit for that. Okay, so then the government can say, oh, you see, the policies worked in the end because, you know, the society didn't collapse, and today we have a certain amount of economic activity that actually we can call capitalist and all this kind of stuff. But in reality, it's not because they implemented good policies, it is because their bad policies were cushioned by people. So as a result, to show how people survived during those very, very hard economic times actually reveals who actually helped the society to survive. Another very important consideration is that when we ignore household economies, we actually ignore a huge chunk of economic activity which is necessary for survival of any society. And feminist economists have long started making this point. So if you just imagine the situation that household economies stopped functioning. And because in many societies and in most societies today, household economies are primarily fueled by women's work, let's say all women stopped doing what they're doing on their daily basis. They would stop taking care of children, they would stop cooking, cleaning, they would stop making food preserves, they would stop going to the store and bringing food home, and so on and so on. So probably just in a few days, the whole society would come to the full stop. So you would have people who are hungry, who are not taken care of. It would be very, very chaotic situation. But we take it for granted that women in this world sustain their households and the entire societies in this way. And we never think of it as a fundamental economic practice. But production of goods and services in the household is exactly that. And the fact that it is women's work, which is so essential, is being ignored, contributes to all these other patriarchal hierarchies in the society when women's work is not valued and appreciated, when their access to employment is limited because of their responsibilities at home that are being ignored. And also, all this is not seen as work unless we have a dollar amount attached to it. And so, according to feminist economists, if we were to put dollar amount on all work which is done in households in the world and in all countries, then the GDP of those countries would go up by at least one third. So the huge amount of economic activity is totally ignored by the fact that it is invisible. It is occurring inside the households and it is done by women.
So we've been talking about, on the one hand, the formal economic sphere. And of course, when we think of waged labor, we think of often the left thinks of exploitation, right? The fact that people who work for a wage are exploited. And then we've been talking about the informal economy, where it's domestic production of goods and services, the gift economy, networks of help and child care and elder care, informal finances. One might be tempted to say that these informal economic spaces are in some sense a haven from exploitation. Is that how you see it?
I think it is more complicated. I think it depends. In some situations, all this can be a site of heightened exploitation. So by no means we should just kind of, you know, idealize what is happening in the informal economy and in household economy. There are many patriarchal households where women's work is being appropriated by the husbands without women really having any control of what they do, have a choice to do or not to do certain domestic tasks, let's say. Then the informal economy is infamous for exploitation of migrant workers, for example, who do not have protections as formal workers have. So it is very, very complicated landscape. But at the same time, there are economic practices that take place in the informal and non-monetized economies and within the households and communities that intend to help people, that are guided by ethics of care and cooperation. And those economic practices could be the economic practices that we want to cultivate. And at some point in the future, imagine the economy that would be modeled after those practices, as opposed to competitive, profit-oriented economic activity that is exploitative, destroying the environment, and has no future for so many people in this world. So I think, why it is important to look at the informal economy, but also to kind of sort out what is happening within it and identify the economic practices that could be the basis for our economic imaginations.
Now, since we have a few minutes, I want to go back to the privatization campaign in the early post-Soviet era. And I wonder if you can tell us about some of the mechanisms and methods by which enterprises were privatized.
In general, economy was privatized in a number of ways. First of all, when the law about privatization took place, people just could create new economic enterprises that would be privately owned. And this is what existed only to a very, very limited degree in the late 1980s. So a lot of new economic activity were those newly created privately owned enterprises. The existing enterprises were privatized, and they were privatized using the so-called voucher privatization. So all citizens of Russia were issued a privatization voucher that at the time was worth about 10,000 rubles or several dollars. And the role of this voucher was that you could go and invest it either into your own enterprise if it's being privatized, or you can invest it into the newly created enterprise, or you can do whatever you wanted with it. In many cases, people were trying to privatize the enterprise in which they worked and become co-owners of those enterprises. So that was favored in the very beginning, and it was privatization by employees of enterprises using those vouchers. However, many people did not know what to do with their vouchers because all this happened so fast, and just the concept of privatizing something using a voucher was very, very alien to people. So very soon after privatization, those vouchers became part of the market of the vouchers. So there were people standing in all these places, like near the subway stations, let's say in Moscow, who had held signs, I want to buy your voucher. And you would go to them and they would give you those 10,000 rubles. And many people would rather do that and get 10,000 rubles because the situation, economic situation already was very, very harsh, than to try to figure out what to do with this voucher. They did not have imagination of capitalist economy at all at this point because nobody really explained how it should or should not work. So as a result, a lot of people didn't actually invest, but the vouchers were amassed by entrepreneurs or former party executives who then could invest vast quantities of those vouchers and become almost sole owners of enterprises or would control majority of ownership in a particular enterprise. So this is how it was happening in the beginning. And then a lot of businesses that were privatized by employees actually went out of business because they didn't know how to navigate this new economic context.
So what should we take? What do you think we should take? What are the lessons we can learn from the welfare system as it existed in the USSR in terms of practices today and policy today and potential transformation today?
So today, to a large degree, it is kind of history, but I think it is very important to look at how it worked and actually understand that it was in place for decades and provided to the needs of hundreds of millions of people. So it was the system that actually did function quite successfully. And also, I think what is important is that it demonstrated that it is possible to think about creating a welfare system that would be universal and would be providing for people. And it is also important in the context of today's changes in welfare systems, not only in Russia, but in many places in the world. This kind of neoliberalizing climate that leads to a cutting down of welfare benefits in the United States and in Europe could be contrasted to what the Soviet system was like. So in the West, and especially in the United States, thinking about universal health care seems to be totally out of place. Like, people don't even understand why and how we can do it. But one can go to the former Soviet Union and realize that universal health care did exist for decades and provided very, very good support to the Soviet population. So I think the value of understanding how Soviet welfare system is not only in looking historically at what it did, but also it could be opening imaginations of people in other countries thinking about what kind of welfare system they want to have.
That's Mariana Pavlovskaya. She is professor of geography at Hunter College, City University of New York. And again, you can read her very interesting chapter about post-Soviet Russia in the volume Making Other Worlds Possible, Performing Diverse Economies. Mariana, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, C.S. It was a pleasure.
Thanks to Joe Pelez for his engineering assistance, Jill Montgomery for her technical assistance, and Kimberly Schreiber for her production help. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.